Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Without further ado, Casey, welcome. Thank you so much for being here today. For all of you who are new, Casey is a recurrent speaker in RFRX. We do keep bringing her back, and she's absolutely amazing. For those of you who are longtime viewers, you will already know her because I think this is like your fifth, sixth session, something like that. So thank you so much for taking the time and welcome.
Thanks, Amaya. I'm happy to be here. Yes, my fifth one.
Is it the fifth? Oh, wow, that's amazing. By the way, we're about to make a year of these RFRX sessions. By the end of the month, it will be a year. So that's really exciting. You have been here from the very beginning. So, I mean, yeah, you have been part of the team for so long. It's just amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be a part of this. Great.
Cool. So I used to introduce like speakers reading their bios, but I realized that it's better if I just do the speakers do their own thing. So do you want to just tell the audience a bit more about yourself, your background, you know, your where you're coming from, what we're going to speak about, all that jazz?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm Casey, and I'm a licensed therapist in Wake Forest, North Carolina. I have a private practice specializing in perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. I'm a secular therapist. I participate in the secular therapy project as well. And I love supporting new moms and particularly non-believers because where I live in North Carolina, there's a shortage of secular therapists around here. So happy to be one of the few offering secular therapy services.
And pretty tonight, sure that's very appreciated. Oh. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that tonight, talking about cognitive dissonance, pretty timely. Anytime is a good time to talk about cognitive dissonance, really. It's a really interesting topic. I wouldn't say I'm an expert at it or in that area, but so I did a lot of research for this talk. I just kind of knew the basics. So I have some really good resources that I can share with you guys if you're interested in learning more. It's fascinating. There's certainly not a lack of information online about it or books on it, but I can recommend some really good ones that I came across in my research.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. I agree. I think cognitive dissonance is very timely now, but it has always been. And it's such a broad topic. So I guess the first thing to start with is just defining what it is, cognitive dissonance, and why should we care about cognitive dissonance?
Okay, yeah. Well, the main guy who I coined the phrase and who did a ton of research into it was a social psychologist named Leon Festinger. And so his definition is a psychological state in which an individual's cognitions, that's beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors, are at odds. So it's that feeling that you get when you have two conflicting ideas. Or you have a belief and you find out information that contradicts that belief, and it creates this feeling of, oh, I might be wrong. So it's that feeling, and we don't like that feeling as humans. We like to know stuff, and we like to be right. So it comes up all the time for us, and our brains naturally do this. We're hardwired to have the need to resolve that feeling of dissonance. So the opposite of dissonance is consonance. So consonance is when, you know, everything's cool and, you know, you're basically feeling pretty confident about your beliefs and what you think and what you know. And dissonance is the opposite of that. when you feel like, oh, wait, I don't know everything. Maybe I'm wrong about that. So basically that's the definition of it. Mm-hmm. One of the books that I highly recommend if anybody wants to read more about this this idea is a book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. And the third edition came out in 2019. And it's just great. And it's very relatable and it's understand, you can really understand it. You don't need any kind of like psychology degree to know what they're talking about. They have really good examples that everybody can relate to. And there, so Tavris and Aronson also have their own definition of cognitive dissonance. And theirs is the hardwired psychological mechanism that creates self-justification and protects our certainties, self-esteem, and tribal affiliations.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess the follow-up question is, why is cognitive dissonance relevant like nowadays? Why should we care about fixing cognitive dissonance? And yeah, because it is a quite uncomfortable feeling, isn't it? And it's easier to just ignore it completely and just, get on with your life. So why should we care about it?
Yeah, we should care because, first of all, I think it's important to know that nobody is immune to this feeling. Our brains just naturally do it. Our brains want us to look for, our brains like to sort things and categorize things and keep us safe. And the easiest way for our brains to do that is to look for things that are the same and stay away from things that are different. And so we need to know that it's natural for this to come up. And we need to know that it's okay. It's not gonna hurt us to feel uncomfortable. That when you're feeling that feeling that I might need to think more about this. Am I making the right decision here? Maybe I should read more information. Maybe I was wrong. If that's something that's coming up for you, it's a good time to explore that a little bit more and sit with that discomfort and know that even though we're hardwired to experience this, we're not, it's the automatic part of it does not apply to what we do next, to what we do with the feeling. So and we're gonna talk about some ways to deal with it. And I think it's important because it's important to have an open mind and to always be willing to learn a new and better way to think about the world.
Mm-hmm. So how would you suggest approaching the situation when you do realize that you are like experiencing cognitive dissonance? Because it's a very uncomfortable feeling, as we said, and it can be quite an attack to our egos, I guess, of realizing that there's something that's not quite right.
Right. Yeah, I thought I might share a couple of examples that can maybe illustrate the whole idea to people. So one example is like smoking, right? So if we have any smokers in the crowd tonight, smoking is one of those things that a lot of people do. I think that the trend is, I think that number of people who smoke, it's actually going down, but it's a good one because everybody can kind of relate to it. Any bad habit, substitute any bad habit. I smoke, I don't, but like this is an example. So it might happen like this. I smoke. I know that smoking is dangerous to my health. Maybe I've been to the doctor and the doctor is saying, you really need to give up those cigarettes. That creates dissonance. Right? Because I like to smoke. It helps me relax. But I know I'm reading all of this evidence that says it's bad for me. So there's the dissonance. And my brain is wanting me to not feel that way. So I've got to do something about it. So I can quit smoking, which is hard, or I can justify it. I can say, well, but smoking helps me manage my weight. And obesity is a huge problem. I mean, it's probably even more dangerous than these cigarettes. I mean, I could die from like diabetes or something. I mean, obesity leads to all kinds of problems. Cigarette smoking is not that bad when you really think about it. So that's kind of how that goes. Mm-hmm. Another example might be, you know, because it's getting close to tax time here in the US. Maybe you're filling out your income tax forms and you're jotting down all your expenses that are tax deductible. And maybe you play around with the numbers a little bit just to make it come out in your favor a little bit more. And that creates some dissonance, right? Because nobody really wants the IRS to come after them. And it's lying. So, you know, so there's probably a little voice saying like, I don't know, like you should probably be honest with the IRS. But then there's another little side that says, but come on, who's gonna know? Everybody does it. Everybody kind of, you know, fudges those numbers a little bit on their taxes. The government wastes all that money anyway, and they take too much of our paychecks already, don't they? They'll never know, and it's really not that bad. That's another example, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to resolve that feeling, justifying what I'm doing in order to feel better about myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I can definitely see myself in those examples. I mean, not the specific examples, but yeah. So
right, Amaya would never do that.
I will never. That's not at all. So what is the evolutionary sort of origin of cognitive dissonance? Why, what is it there for, I guess? Because it must have some sort of function.
It does. It's really fascinating. So like I was saying earlier, our brains are kind of lazy, right? Like, you know, evolution has been pretty lazy. Like it doesn't change anything, but it doesn't have to, because it's very slow evolution. So we got to this point, and our brains are like the quick, want things figured out quickly. Because, you know, early humans, we may have been running from a tiger or something, or, you know, we were protecting our young from a lion or whatever. And so we really need to be able to think quickly about things. So our brains haven't really kept up with our modern world and all of the information that we have access to. So our brains will try to take little shortcuts, and they don't, you know, our brains don't like things that are complicated or gray or complex, you know. So it will try to cut through all of that and make a quick decision. And mm-hmm. it all goes back to kind of tribalism and looking for things that are like us and avoiding things that are different. And, you know, trying to really like encourage our confidence in ourselves, right? Because if we're confident and we know how to look for people that we trust, those people who think like we do and who see the world like we do, we have a better chance of survival. So that's kind of the evolutionary, what they think, why they think that we have held on to this kind of, you know, phenomenon. So that's, I think that's really important to know that, like, you know, it's going to happen no matter what we do. So, and we see it all the time. We see it in politics and relationships. We see celebrities getting into one scandal or another all the time. So no matter what, no matter who you are, no matter how smart you are, how much money you have, you know, we all do this. We all try to resolve this dissonance when our beliefs are challenged.
How can we like sort of overcome that kind of evolutionary baggage that we have from, you know, our ancestors? Because this is definitely something that I feel like keeps happening. Like we were evolved to like have a specific function or, you know, behave in a specific way. And then that sort of behavior doesn't adapt properly anymore, but our bodies aren't, our brains aren't able to like actually adapt to our new times, and it's just, it keeps bringing us back. So how can we overcome this cognitive dissonance in our everyday lives?
Yeah, well, we have to, you know, everything comes back to mindfulness, I feel like. I feel like I talk about mindfulness in some way every time I do one of these talks. But it really is, the key is to actually stop and, you know, catch yourself when you're feeling this way and sit with that feeling a little bit. It's not fun, but, you know, be uncomfortable and challenge your thinking. And some things you can ask yourself when it happens, you know, am I being lazy right now? Or, you know, am I thinking? Am I trying to take a shortcut to resolve this uncomfortable feeling by just talking myself out of whatever or justifying, you know, what I just did? And really thinking about your values, right? Because like with the income tax form example, you know, if your values are honesty, integrity, things like that, being responsible, then, you know, that can help you kind of talk yourself out of doing the easy thing. Because if you're going to stick with your values, then, you know, you're not going to lie. So therefore, I'm not going to lie on my income tax form, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. So values is, you know, so just paying attention to what's important to you, mm-hmm. is a good place to start. Just being, you know, taking some time and telling yourself, like, you know, most of the time we don't have to make these like split second decisions about things. So you can probably spend some time reflecting on what this decision is that you're making and what you need to do. And if you have done something that you feel like you shouldn't have done, maybe you said something hurtful to your spouse or to a friend, and you're feeling bad about it, pay attention to that, you know, and kind of spend some time just reflecting on what happened. And instead of reducing your dissonance, what else could you do? You know, is there a way to make it right? That might hurt your pride a little bit, but what if that could be an opportunity for you to grow as a person, or to open up a new line of communication with that person who means something to you? Mm-hmm. If you tell, you know, if one of your values is open communication with people who matter, then, you know, what is a values driven way for you to resolve that dissonance? Well, it's to maybe have a really hard talk with that person instead of just saying like, well, I'm right and he's wrong and he's always wrong and he is always mean to me anyway. And he never keeps his promises. So I'm just, you know, I'm not going to talk to him anymore. Right. Like, because I know I'm right and he deserves to be treated this way anyway. So that's a simple way to resolve the dissonance, right? I'm right. He's wrong. But the more painful way is the way that opens yourself up to growing as a person and to really, deepening, you know, relationships with people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so time, reflecting, self-reflection, and being willing to change your mind. So being flexible.
Yeah, I think the last one is the most difficult part, like being willing to be that uncomfortable, because it's not always easy. And I know that in the description that you offered, you said that there is a relationship between mental health and cognitive dissonance. So can you explain that? Can you explain what that relationship is a bit, please?
Yeah, you know, when we seek to resolve or to reduce that uncomfortable feeling, in a quick and easy way. Sometimes that can lead us to just be really rigid in our thinking. And we tend to start thinking in all or nothing, you know, right or wrong, black or white. And life is just not that way. It's very gray and complex. And, you know, think about the relationships that you're in. They're probably complicated. You are complicated as a human. When you sit down to go on social media, think about all of the information that's coming at you that you've got to filter through, and the ads that are targeting you, and all of that. Like, it's overwhelming to be a human in these modern times. So we can start to experience anxiety from all of that, from constantly trying to resolve this dissonant feeling. And so I think just taking a moment and being more mindful can not only help us reduce that dissonance in maybe a constructive way, in a healthy way, but can also help us relieve any of that depression or anxiety that's coming up for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to know the link between resolving dissonance and self-justification, right? We have this need to justify what we do. And, you know, there's a purpose to that too, because if we didn't, we would, you know, if we didn't have this need to justify our decisions, we would agonize constantly over every single decision that we have to make. And, you know, this kind of goes back to the evolutionary theory too, that we get caught up, you know, deciding what to have for lunch and just, you know, being in a panic about it. So we have to make, you know, quick decisions sometimes. So it's important to know that, like, yes, it's okay to want to justify your decisions, but also to know that when we're mindless about it, and we make snap decisions and we're constantly justifying what we've done to save face, then you know, that leads to disaster for us, for our relationships, for our, maybe our jobs, for finances. You know, when you really want that fancy car and you know you can't afford it, but you're talking yourself into it because, I mean, that new car smell, come on, like, who doesn't want that? And you know, you just are constantly like talking yourself into it because all you can think about is, you know, seeing yourself driving around that sports car. But to resolve the dissonance in a slower, healthier way would be to think about your budget and maybe what your spouse might think about this huge purchase. And if there's a slower way to get what you want, maybe you save up for the car. Maybe you go around to different dealerships and check out the different prices before you make your decision. You know, that's not fun or sexy, but that's healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as a control freak myself, I do like to like try to keep everything under control. And I feel like sometimes with cognitive dissonance, you're just not aware that you are in a state of cognitive dissonance until someone points it out to you. So do you have any sort of tips on how to sort of realize? I know it's a bit of an abstract question because it's very difficult to just become aware of something that you're unaware of, but if there's any sort of advice that you can provide in that topic, because I think I'm sure all of us in the audience, we do appreciate truth and we all want to like know more truth facts about the world, and sometimes it can be difficult if you are struggling with cognitive dissonance. So yeah,
and I think, you know, I think with our crowd here, we tend to appreciate science, right? So if you think about the scientific method, that if we kind of apply that to our decision making, or when we're reading something and it really gets our attention and seems maybe like too good to be true, or something just doesn't like sound right about it. You know, like those are strong feelings that are stirred up for us, especially for those of us who are reflective and maybe a bit skeptical. So pay attention to that. And, you know, use the scientific method to kind of work your way through something that you're reading and check out the sources of where this information is coming from. Search for, you know, views that are different from what this, you know, article is saying, or for one of your views that you feel strongly about. Look for opposing viewpoints on it and read about it. Mm-hmm. And just see, you know, just check it out, be uncomfortable, challenge yourself to do the work. You know, I mean, lately, you know, on social media, I think, you know, Facebook, Twitter, they're trying to be, I guess they're really trying, it's a little too late, but they're trying to get people to think about things before you retweet or you share. You know, especially on Twitter now, like if there's an article and you try to retweet it, it will say, do you want to read that article first? And it's like, you know, it's just a little bit of a pause that, you know, you don't have to, you could just go ahead and click retweet, but it does make you think, oh, maybe I should check this out and make sure that it's true before I start sharing it with other people. So I think, so anytime you can just take a breath and think before you act, think before you plead your case as to why you've made a certain decision. I think that's important to just take a minute, you know? So I think I mentioned values. So, you know, thinking about your values, remembering that the feeling you're having, the anxiety that comes up, the dissonance is not, it's not going to hurt you, you know? So I think reminding yourself that I can do hard things. I can take a minute and reflect on this. I can apologize if there's something I've apologized for. I can not only apologize, but I can think about ways to prevent myself from doing, you know, X, Y, or Z again. If it's something that you've done that was hurtful, or you've said something you didn't mean, or you know, you've discovered that you do have a bias, like maybe you think of yourself as a really open-minded person, and completely unbiased, and you know, free thinking, all those great things, but we all have biases. We just can't help it. We do. And it's the important part of that is to not go through life pretending like you're unbiased, but to acknowledge those biases and start really paying attention to how those biases, you know, how those thoughts play out in your life and what, you know, what you're doing with those thoughts. And with those preconceived notions about this or that group. So it really is, I mean, the self-reflection is a key, and they've done some research on people who are more reflective, you know, tend to, you know, look for like fact check articles before they share it with people. And they read about candidates before they place their vote. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that have come up recently in politics here in the US, where they have asked, you know, Republicans and Democrats how they went about making a decision on who to vote for. And they found that Republicans tend to be less self-reflective than those who vote Democrat, which is just interesting. So it really comes down to just educating yourself and thinking before you act, and knowing that if you can just take a minute and think your way through something, you will probably make a better decision. And even if you made a bad decision, it's what's the worst that could happen? I mean, sometimes there are really bad decisions that we make, but most of the time, it's not life or death, and you can probably go back and repair the damage that you've done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like if you think about, you know, like if you, I can't think of anybody recently, but you know, when like a celebrity gets caught doing something they shouldn't be doing, most of the time they try to talk themselves out of it, right? They try to lie, deny it, whatever. And but once in a while you get somebody who actually acknowledges what they've done and they come clean and they explain that they're gonna try to make things right. One that that just came to mind is the comedian Aziz Ansari. Do you know him, Amaya?
No, sorry. I don't know many like comedians, if I'm fully honest. So yeah, no.
But he would, when the Me Too movement started, when was that, like 2018, I guess, 2017? He was called out by some women, I think, who had worked for him. And he had said some, you know, like male chauvinistic things. I don't think it wasn't like, it wasn't rape or anything like that, but he had been, he had made some sexist comments. And he got called out for it. And he did a whole, he released a whole special on, I think it was Netflix, basically owning up to it and talking candidly about what happened and admitting that, like, you know, he was kind of a douche. And, you know, he wanted to talk about it and not just explain away, you know, why he did it or why he was right, or, you know, she was lying or he said, she said, but really just owning what he did and saying, you know, I don't know all the answers, but I'm going to try to be better. And he did it in a funny way in front of an audience. And, I don't know. I just thought that was really brave. And that's something that we can all kind of take a lesson from. You know, like we're all going to make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. In America, we're very mistake or failure phobic. You know, we don't ever like to admit that we've been wrong about something or that we made an error. But you know, they've studied other cultures, and there was one about kids in a classroom, and in Japan, they watched a kid work on a math problem for 45 minutes, and the teacher didn't stop him, and he kept making mistakes, and then he would go and erase it, and then he'd think some more about it, and then he'd go back, and then he'd start over again, and he stood there at the whiteboard and worked his way through it for 45 minutes until he like got the answer. Now, in an American classroom, the teacher would have been rushing that kid to come up with the right answer. And there's so much shame associated with making a mistake. And that's part of, I think that's kind of, that ties into the mental health aspect too. But we have to take the shame out of it, because it isn't shameful to get something wrong. You know, how else are we supposed to learn? And we have to be okay with messing up, really, because that way we learn from those mistakes. If we don't ever make a mistake, how are we supposed to get better at something? And so I think it's a cultural shift that also has to happen. It's not just up to every one of us, but it's up to, you know, us as a society, to, you know, to encourage people to try new things and think in different ways and, you know, see the world in a different way and appreciate a different viewpoint and go ahead and, you know, fall on your ass, but at least you tried and you learn every time. You know, if you think about it, you can probably remember things that you failed at or mistakes you've made and how much you grew from that experience. But we aren't always forgiving when people mess up. And I think we have to be more patient with people, and we have to embrace failure as just part of the learning process.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned values before, and I think that's a very interesting topic and something that we should definitely touch on, because a lot of extraly used people do go through like a shift in values, and that can be very difficult, very challenging to face, and just very difficult in general. So do you want to explore that a bit, in the sense of not just small values, like you think you said something rude to a person, which obviously shouldn't, but I mean something more like, I used to believe that having sex before marriage was awful, and I used to tell everyone that it was awful, and now I don't think the same way. Do you want to explore that topic, I guess, for a bit?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think cognitive dissonance probably, it works both ways. I think it can keep people believing in, beliefs that really aren't serving them, because the dissonance is, you know, the dissonance of thinking about leaving that faith is probably, it could certainly create discomfort. And so they might stay in a religion they really don't believe in anymore to avoid, you know, leaving behind their support network, leaving behind the church family, and whatever the case may be. And then for other people, the dissonance comes from, you know, attending services and claiming to believe in things that just really don't sit right with them. And, you know, so it can lead some people away from their religion. But in terms of values, I think if you really, when you think about certain religious beliefs, they don't quite square with some of your values. So I think when you realize that you can have secular values and be a good person, that is a healthy way to resolve that dissonance that maybe is created from those, you know, those religious beliefs that are so rigid and impossible to live with. That when you start to realize that, oh, okay, well, I can still stick to all my core values, being honest, being whatever your values may be. And it doesn't mean that I have to follow in this, this religious path of these really strict guidelines. I can be my own person and have values and be a good person.
Because, I was thinking just how difficult it must be to go through that process of when you're in a religion and you're kind of starting to feel like things aren't making that much sense, and you begin to be in that state of cognitive dissonance, and then having to overcome that with all the implications that this has. It's not just, you know, should I buy myself a treat or not? It's like, it's your whole life and your whole value system, which I think is quite challenging. But yeah, that did answer the question. Yeah, thanks.
Right, and it takes time, you know, like, it takes time for people to figure out, you know, how they want to leave their religion. And it's different for everybody, depending on your family situation or the actual beliefs. Like, maybe you're going to walk away and be shunned, and you've got to recreate your whole support network again. And so that is a really, you know, that's a really heavy decision to make, and it is life-changing. It's not just, you know, like some of the examples we'll be talking about. It's a serious one, and not an easy decision to make just overnight to up and, you know, become an atheist. It takes time for most people.
Yeah.
But it's important to take that time and to explore how you really feel about things, and to seek out support, and to do your research, and all of those healthy ways that you can seek to resolve that dissonance.
So yeah, one of the questions that someone submitted for the Q&A that I think is quite relevant now is, why doesn't religion turn off more people by causing cognitive dissonance and confusion? So why don't more people leave after experiencing this state of cognitive dissonance?
Great question. I would say that the dissonance it causes for those people is not uncomfortable enough. You know, it's not more uncomfortable than, say, the idea of leaving it behind. Does that make sense? Like, so staying, you know, attending church, you know, and listening to sermons and hanging out with people who believe stuff, and inside you know you don't believe it, is not uncomfortable enough to leave. So I think the dissonance, you know, I think for a lot of people, it, you know, it may start out that way, where you're just, you know, there's just some doubts in your mind. So but the more that dissonance grows, it, you know, at some point, for many people, it gets to be too much, like that dissonance, you know, of, I really don't believe this. This is really uncomfortable to sit here and pretend like I do believe this. And, you know, give my money to the church every Sunday, or, you know, teach Sunday school or whatever you're doing, playing that role, becomes so dissonant with who you really are that, you know, it has to be greater than the dissonance and the risk you're taking to leave before you leave, I think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it must be just so difficult. I mean, it's potentially the biggest change in someone's life if they are in that situation. So yeah, I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because it depends on the, you know, it depends on that person's situation. If, you know, if they have a family and they think that their spouse is going to keep them from seeing their kids or something, if they leave their faith, you know, like they have a lot to lose. So they have to be very careful about leaving. Or if it's a religion where your life may be at stake, if you live in a country where, you know, it's not okay to be a secular person, then, you know, that's life-threatening kind of dissonance, which is, you know, that's serious. And yes, I think that's why that happens. I think that's why people get stuck.
Mm-hmm. And what about when you perceive cognitive dissonance in others? Because I guess, you know, it's one thing to see it in yourselves. I think it's much easier to see it in other people because we all love to feel like we know more than anyone else. So do you have, I guess, could you explore that topic of how to approach that, but in a respectful way, in a way that's not too invasive? Because it can be quite easy to just become quite like arrogant and snappy about, you know, I'm right and you're wrong. So if you do see someone that's in a state of cognitive dissonance, how do you approach that person?
Yeah, so you're talking about like if you are, like if you have an encounter with someone who is like very dogmatic and trying to like maybe preach to you and you're feeling that dissonance, or is that kind of what you're talking about?
It could be, yeah. I mean, it can take so many different forms. I was specifically picturing like an argument that you're having with someone and they're saying something that makes no logical sense. So they're obviously in a state of, you know, cognitive dissonance. So yeah, in that sort of sense, but it can be definitely applied to a religious family member for sure.
Yeah, well, and I think, so say with religion, or say with, you know, somebody who believes, you know, that COVID is a hoax, or maybe they've been, maybe they're in to some kind of like online scam where you know, they're giving their money to somebody and thinking they're gonna win a big prize or something. And you're just like, how can you believe this, right? Like, for you, the dissonance is, I thought you were a smart person. How can you be falling for this, right? And it's very tricky. It usually doesn't help to say what you're thinking, which is, are you stupid? Right? That's not gonna get you anywhere. So there's a couple of resources I want to mention that have to do with this. The streetepistemology.com is a really good website. Yeah. And there's an app called Atheos. It is so cool. I just found out about it, but it's been out for a while. I think the Center for Skeptical Inquiry, is that the Richard Dawkins Foundation? I can't remember what it's called, but I think they funded it, and it's free on the App Store or the whatever the other one is, the Android store. And it takes you through, it's a whole course on how to talk to people who have differing beliefs. And it gives you options. And that's the key, I think, to know that, like, there is not just one way to do it. And it's okay to walk away from somebody when you feel like you're not getting anywhere. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's the best answer, you know, and maybe that's not the easiest way to resolve your dissonance, but sometimes it's the smartest thing to do. You know, the easiest way is probably just to say, like, well, you're stupid and I can't talk to you anymore, and walk away. But if you know, just simply, like, you know, say, I don't have time to talk about this right now, or whatever. So that's one thing. So definitely check that out. But another way to talk to people is by getting to the values aspect again. So, like, if somebody is coming to you and telling you about, you know, this brand new essential oil they found that cures cancer and will keep you from ever getting another cold, and it builds up your immune system so you won't get COVID, and you don't need that silly vaccine, just take this essential oil and rub it on your wrist every night, or diffuse it, or whatever. And you're like, that's not accurate. I don't believe that science has proven that. You know, that's what you want to say. But if you get more down to the values of the person, so maybe you know this person values maybe science. I don't see how you would value science and still fall for that, but you know, maybe you can take the scientific method and kind of walk them through that. Or if they typically feel like, you know, they're pretty smart, then you can come at it from, like, an intelligence, you know, kind of angle. But other times you just have to walk away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that you mentioned in the resources street epistemology, because we actually had Anthony Magnabosco, I think it was a couple of days ago, and I see him in the audience. Thank you, Anthony, for coming back. And he did a fantastic topic on this. So if anyone is interested in it, it will be up in our YouTube channel eventually. And it was really, really good. It was like an intermediate level, like, epistemology brief session. And it was really good. I think learning to have those conversations is definitely such a great tool in approaching cognitive dissonance, which is, I think, one of the main sources of disagreements in a lot of people. So yeah, I just think it was really funny, because we had that talk like literally 2 weeks ago. And yeah. I also didn't know about the app, but I'll make sure to download it. Is there any other resources in this topic?
There is a great podcast called You Are Not So Smart. And they just kind of challenge a lot of different ideas. Talk to really smart people. And there is an episode that was, I don't know how recent it was, probably in the last 2 months, that was all about, the title of it was Self-Reflection and Insurrection. Mm-hmm. And it was after the storming of the Capitol here in the US, and just really talking about, you know, how does someone get from, you know, just maybe like doubting or being skeptical of mainstream media, you know, how do they get from that point to rioting at the Capitol, you know, and that slippery slope. That's, and really it's about when you are not reflecting at all, you know, on your own, in your own mind, and really questioning why you're doing things and why you're believing things, that self-reflection is definitely, you know, a huge part of avoiding something like that, falling for pseudoscience, lies, whatever it may be.
Fake news, all that jazz.
Yeah.
I feel like lately on Twitter, I've been getting really annoyed at people on the topic of cognitive dissonance. And I do follow mostly, like, I do have like an echo chamber following, if not follow people following me, but me following other people, that we all kind of share the same views. But I do follow people like Ben Shapiro and people like that. And it's just so, I don't know, I find it so difficult to understand how someone else that is an obviously intelligent person would believe certain things that they believe in. So I think it's such a like a fascinating topic, and it's something that I think we can all see, especially mm-hmm. nowadays, where you have such an overload of information and you don't really know how to filter it, and you're connected with so many people that from all sorts of different backgrounds. So
yeah, and that's a good point. You know, there's an idea called the pyramid of choice. And so if you think about a pyramid, and so if you start at the top, and you have a decision that you're making, and it mainly applies to big, you know, life decisions, moral, ethical dilemmas, things like that. And so you make it, so it happens very gradually. You make one decision to go a certain way, you know, start maybe like reading right wing news outlets. And then the more you get deeper and deeper, it's not like you go from just being, you know, a person that is open minded to, you know, storming the Capitol. It's a very gradual shift that happens, and you make one decision, and then you start seeking people who will confirm for you that you're on the right track, you know. So other, and social media, the algorithms are designed to keep you going down that pyramid, because they're just going to keep, you know, piling other, like, you know, confirming ideas like into your feed, and you're just going to keep seeing more and more of that, and you're going to be like, I knew I was right about that thing, and then you're going to join all the groups that agree with you, and then you're going to be protesting, and then, you know, on and on and on, and by the time you get down to the bottom of the pyramid, you have all of this evidence that confirms what you already, you know, thought you believed, and you're surrounded by other people who are telling you, we believe that too. Yes, yes. It is a total conspiracy. And so it's really hard once you get to the bottom of that pyramid to make your way back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw a couple of like street interviews to a few people who believed, they were very strong Trump supporters, and they believed that Biden wasn't like, well, that the election was rigged essentially. And the reason why they believed this was because they personally didn't know anybody that had voted for Biden. Mm-hmm. And it was just so strange, because it's like, I mean, fair enough, you don't know anybody around you, but surely you must understand that there's people in the world that did vote for him, yeah, I don't know. That was, yeah, that was just such a weird mm-hmm. experience. And I think Twitter doesn't help in that sense.
Yeah, right.
So is there any other topic that we have missed or any other thing that you wanted to touch on cognitive dissonance before we jump to the Q&A?
I wanted to say this. So we've talked a lot about like the negative side of this and confirmation bias and all the ugly side of cognitive dissonance. And it's important to remember that it also works with, you know, positive things, you know, behaviors that we consider positive, like being generous, you know, so, you know, you do something kind for somebody, a small act, it feels good to do that. And you're probably going to want to feel that way again, right? So the dissonance you're feeling is encouraging you to continue down that path. And that's okay, right? That's a good kind. That's, you know, it's gonna, they refer to this in psychology and sociology as a virtuous circle. So, you know, generosity begets compassion, begets kindness, you know, like, you know, the more you show those kinds of behaviors, the more it really does spread. And what was that? It was like several years ago, pay it forward was like the thing. And so there was like, there were people like in the Starbucks line, like, you know, paying for the person's coffee behind them, and that person would pay for the, you know, and it would keep going. And that's kind of cheesy, but it really is a thing that happens when we show compassion to somebody else.
And Casey, the dissonance in that case be if you don't continue to do that type of behavior, then you'll feel prompted to do it some more?
Yes. So the dissonance is like, oh, like that feels good. I think I want to keep doing that, you know? And then the person you did it for is like, oh, wow, like that was nice. Maybe I'll do that too.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, so that kind of thing, it can grow that way too. And so it doesn't always have to do with conspiracy theories and, you know, hurting people.
Yeah. No, that's an important note to add. Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
There's so much. I mean, I really encourage everybody to read more about it. Cause it's really fascinating. You certainly go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had no idea that they had that relationship with mental health, for example. I was completely clueless. So thank you for sharing that. And also the evolutionary origins of it.
Yeah, me too. I love our brain.
Brains are awesome. And hate it also.
Yeah, our brains are kind of lazy, but like there's a lot of power in there that we just got to access. And, you know, mm-hmm. You have to train it. You have to like train your brain.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. So without further ado, then let's jump to the Q&A because we could be speaking here for hours. So the first question that we have is there a relationship between cognitive dissonance and the development of altruism in as an evolved trait in human individuals and societies?
I wonder if that's kind of what we just talked about, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's why it was like the first question in there. So just kind of, mm-hmm. I guess, developing on that. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're doing, you know, good things, helping other people, you're going to seek out other positive people, you know? So it's like, you know, just like you would seek out people to confirm that that COVID is a hoax, or that, you know, QAnon is whatever, like, you know, you know when you are doing kind things for people, you're seeking out people who do those kinds of things and who help other people, and then the compassionate, you know, and compassion is actually one of the you know, factors for, you know, our well-being, our mental well-being. Compassion and gratitude are two of the biggest factors for just being, you know, happy. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense, yeah. Betalina, I'll let you ask the second question, if that's okay.
Yes, we have a question here about post hoc justification, whether that would be a form of cognitive dissonance. And that's like when the reasoning comes after.
Yeah, like that's the idea that we do something and then we get called out for it. And then we say, well, I was going to do that anyway, or I can't think of a good example, but yes, self-justification is the whole, I mean, really like the whole point of resolving cognitive dissonance, right? Like we want to be right about the decisions that we made. And whether it's during the decision-making process or whether it's like justifying something that we've gotten caught doing. So yes, it can happen like while you're in the process, you know, of trying to resolve that dissonance, or it can happen after you've, you know, done something. And, you know, when people do things that are really terrible, you know, like if we think about, you know, an accident, like maybe you're texting and driving and then you hit a kid on a bike or something like that. Like then later on, you might say, well, that kid shouldn't have been riding his bike he should have been watching out for cars. I mean, what is he doing riding a bike in this busy intersection anyway, right? So that's like, you're justifying it by saying it was the kid's fault. But you know, a healthier way, a more you know, constructive approach to that would be to honestly look at what you were doing and owning up to it, and not carrying it around for the rest of your life, but really taking some time to think about your responsibility and making sure that you avoid texting and driving in the future.
Thank you. The next question I really like, but I also think it's a bit difficult. So it's, how do you overcome the view of free will as an illusion? So I personally don't believe in free will, but obviously I'm aware that many people do. So I don't necessarily want to get into a debate now of whether it exists or it doesn't, but maybe something to explore, like a bit of an open question of cognitive dissonance and free will.
Maybe we could get Sam Harris on here.
I love that. Honestly,
wouldn't that be awesome?
Oh, that'd be the best.
That'd be amazing.
That's it. I mean, go read his book on free will. That is not my wheelhouse for sure. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely cognitive dissonance there though, right? Like we like to think that we have free will. But free will is not the same thing as thinking about your actions and deciding, you know, to do something different. Like that's not the same thing. Free will, is the idea that we really are, in control of our own destiny and we can really like do whatever we want. Like we, you know, our genetics are there. Like we're basically, I don't know. I'm not going to talk anymore about it because it's not my thing. So,
yeah, that's okay. No, that I know it was a bit of a off-topic question, but just still interesting. Yeah. So, thank you to the person
that submitted it. Yeah, that's a good topic for another talk.
All right, so we have one here. I cut it down a little. It says that we learn to walk by falling, basically talking about how we learn from our mistakes. So basically, at which point do we as humans make the choice that falling is no longer a part of learning?
I think that's a cultural phenomenon, really. Because if you look at other cultures, falling, as in making mistakes, failures, that's seen as just, you know, part of learning. Part of the learning process is messing up. And I love that metaphor of learning to walk. you know, if we didn't fall down, we never would learn to walk. And so we, you know, there has to be some pain, there has to be some errors, and we have to start looking at it as a part of growth. Like, that's just a step in the process to get better at something, to, you know, when you're, I mean, you just think about anything you try to do that's brand new, it's gonna feel scary. And we're prideful and we don't like to mess up. But if we all just kind of, if we made a cultural shift where we're not shaming everybody every time, you know, somebody says something they didn't mean or makes a mistake, or, you know, I don't know. I think if we were just more open-minded about the process of personal growth, then it would be okay to fall once in a while.
I like that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Someone else is asking, what happens when you are reestablishing your own values but still surrounded by community and family that are inside, I guess it means like inside religion or church. So do you have any tricks to staying strong, continuing to grow in yourself when you still want to maintain a relationship with your family?
That's a recurring topic, isn't it, here? I don't know what that individual situation is, and it certainly like depends on, you know, their own unique circumstances. But I think sometimes if you're stuck maybe living with people who are religious and you've decided that you're leaving your faith, to maintain relationships with the people that you love, maybe focusing on what you still do have in common with them. I mean, that sounds really maybe trite, but if the relationship is meaningful to you, and maybe one of your values is family, but you have family members who, you know, who you don't agree with on certain topics, what do you agree with them on? You know, can you find something to connect with them around, and, you know, have your relationship kind of centered on that instead of the divisive stuff like religion or, you know, politics or whatever it may be. And I think it's really difficult, but, you know, it can be done. And I have a lot of family members who are religious, and it's been a process, and I've just had to figure out like how to set boundaries that I'm comfortable with, so that I can be who I am, and I can, you know, raise my son with secular values, and he can still have a relationship with his grandmother who is a devout Christian. You know, it's really hard. And it's constant work and reassessing and reminding, you know, people of the boundaries, and just, you know, it's not just like a one-time conversation that you have. It's ongoing, and I think everybody's different, and everybody has to figure out what they feel safe with, and, you know, what's okay, what's not okay, communicating with the people in your life about it, and knowing that whatever they have to say is their view. Like, that's their problem. You get to decide how you want to live your life and the boundaries that you're going to set for yourself. And you can change those. You know, maybe you set one limit and then you decide that it's not working for you anymore, and you just set another one. You know, it's a constant process.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. On that topic, last week we had Rebecca speaking about how to keep relationships with like in-laws and extended family who are religious. So if this is something that you're struggling with, and I know that this is a very common, as you said, a very common topic in our audience, the talk will be uploaded to YouTube. So yeah, if you feel like you could use an RFRX talk on that, we have had one on it and it was really good. It was really helpful. It was really, it's really honest discussion about it. So yeah, I know this is such a difficult situation to be in. So I think RFR definitely has resources for you if this is something that you're struggling with. But yeah, I'll ask Madeline.
Yeah, seek support, stick with RFR. They'll be your support system.
That's the plan, yeah.
Yes, we're here. So there's another question that I find interesting. It's about the smoking example. It's asking whether it has to be cognitive dissonance or could it be cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, I think those are kind of related. You know, because the cost to you, you decide how, your own kind of risk, if you're not concerned about your health or whatever, like that's not going to really be a lot of dissonance for you. If you believe that, like, I don't even believe that smoking is dangerous, then it's not going to be, so I think cost benefit analysis plays right into it. I think it's very similar. You could replace that word, cost with dissonance and kind of, come to the same conclusion. So I see it all as like, part of the same process.
All right. Thank you.
That makes sense. Thank you. We have a question that's more of a, like a specific situation. So we have someone that is saying that they have a housemate who was caught in Christian fundamentalism in his teens. He was a wealthy Buddhist Sri Lankan, and his life has been basically destroyed now. He's in his 50s and has almost nothing in terms of positive relationships or material goods. In other words, he has lost everything. So the audience member says that he knows that he doesn't really believe, but he cannot afford to be wrong. Is there any way for someone who has lost so much and face up to the fact that they are wrong and resolve their cognitive dissonance?
It's possible, but it's really hard. That's that pyramid of choice thing, where once you've justified every decision that you made, and you have a lot at stake, it becomes way harder to walk back and change your mind or admit that you were wrong. So I think they asked if it's possible. I think it's possible, but that's a lot of dissonance to deal with. It can be done for sure. That would take a lot of reflection, and that person would need a lot of support, I think. And they'd have to be willing to admit that they were wrong, and that they need support of other people. They might have to give up the support of people who are going to shun them once they walk away. So it's very complicated and a long process, but yeah.
This one has to do with the school system teaching these critical thinking skills. Is that something that if we were taught in school? Like, would there be less of it, or can it even be taught?
Oh gosh, yes. I think yes. Absolutely. This starts so early, especially what I was saying about making mistakes. We're not, you know, it's we're so focused on testing. Well, in the US anyway, I can't speak to the rest of the world, but in our education system, we have these, you know, these ideas or core lessons or whatever areas that, you know, kids have to master before they move on to the next grade. And it's all about these standardized tests, and the teachers are judged based on like how many kids in their class passed or failed, and or the scores that they get. And it is, I just think it fosters this idea of passing, or, you know, like mastering the test for the score, you know, or getting into a good college because I want the prestige of saying I went to this college or had this degree. And I think it would take a lot of work to change it, but I really think that we should focus on that teaching kids to think for themselves, which means, you know, when you think for yourself, you're going to make mistakes, and it's okay. And you have to learn. I think we'd see less anxiety as a whole in our culture if we just allowed kids to play around and learn and fall down, like using that person's learning to walk analogy. Not punishing them or shaming them for getting something wrong, and just embracing failure a little bit more.
Yes, perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Casey, that is all the time we have for questions today, I'm afraid. But thank you so, so much for, you know, taking the time to be here today.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.